Hello, I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Allegra Stratton.
And this is Politics Weekly.
On today's show, we're looking at the latest police report. Will there still be reason to protest?
And the House of Lords. The government says it will kick out the last of the blue bloods, but why not more full-blooded reform?
And as the military death toll in Afghanistan spiked in the last week, we'll also ask if there is a plan.
And in the pod today, we have The Observer's two revered columnists, Nick Cohen and Henry Porter.
We're going to talk about a story that's been on the front page of most newspapers this morning that we, The Guardian, broke, which, well, Henry, you've already written about it, so go and give us a potted history of the story.
Well, it seems that the News of the World has been using, as a matter of almost routine, a man who had the ability to hack into people's text messages. And Scotland Yard estimates that 2,000 to 3,000 people, well-known, mostly well-known people, Boris Johnson, Tessa Jowell, John Prescott, Nigella Lawson, they have had their messages read by the News of the World and copied, it seems. The crucial point was that they weren't just read, that they were then stored in some form and used by the paper for what purpose we do not know. The important thing was that when this began to emerge in a court case, the News of the World mounted an enormous operation to suppress all details about this operation. And to a large extent, until Nick Davis came along, succeeded in fooling the Select Committee, House of Commons, the Independent Press Complaints Commission, and a number of other bodies, that this had not gone on. And in fact, I think probably misled them in a way that is, these days, unacceptable.
Nick, who I should say has lost his mobile phone, so he's not susceptible. Yeah. You came into the pod spluttering about this. Why?
Because there is a real campaign getting going in Britain for freedom of speech, which I'm involved in, to reform our libel laws and the privacy law as well. Our libel laws, as Henry knows from bitter experience, are incredibly draconian. We are becoming a kind of a pariah state around the world where Russian oligarchs and Saudi billionaires can come to Britain, sue, silence criticism. And we were really getting going on all of this. We've Index on Censorship, Private Eye, the scientists are up in arms about what's happened to Simon Singh. We're getting politicians interested. There's a strong feeling among the journalists involved that newspapers, media companies, are getting weaker and weaker as the net takes the money. And one thing we've got to do before we go is sort out libel, because people working on blogs or small organisations, you get a writ.
What and do you mean just before we go?
Well, before we stop being these dominant, rich companies who can afford to fight libel cases. The way we're going, we can't. We need to do some good before we go. And this just absolutely undermines us. You know, there's no suggestion, as far as I can tell, Henry, that any of these stories are in the public interest, looking at some Hollywood actress.
None
she's had a baby, for goodness sake.
None at all.
You know, and what politician is going to say, yeah, we will trust the press a bit
Quite.
More. We will give a bit more.
But don't you think there will be a sense that this is a terrible phrase, but a rotten apple of a case?
Well, it's quite a big rotten apple, it seems. It seems that thousands of phones were hacked, and it seems that such is the influence or the pull of News International that the normal processes of law and regulation, the Press Complaints Commission, which we put up, as you know, you don't need to regulate us, we've got this independent body, were less than interested in following it with necessary rigour.
And there was no kind of moral standard operating in the News of the World. There was no sense that this was wrong or that they just wanted the story. And that is absolutely unacceptable. And why this story should not die is because Murnoch comes to the public and his editors come to the public with some kind of crude moral justification. And this is the thing that actually really should be exposed as being a sort of profound corporate hypocrisy.
Yeah. Can I just bring it back for a moment from high principle to low politics, Henry,
gutter.
And just say gutter politics, indeed, and say one of the editors, the Murdoch editors you've talked about, was Andy Coulson, who's now David Cameron's spin doctor. Do you think he's implicated? Lots of the people who've been caught out are saying they think he is. And do you think he can survive?
I think he is implicated. And I think if he was a proper editor, he knew exactly what was going on in his newsroom. And if he didn't know what was going on, he was doing that, casting his eyes elsewhere, averting his gaze. And I think he probably, therefore, he has a responsibility one way or the other. And I think he is implicated. So if he's implicated, I think it puts him in a very difficult position if he is subsequently going to arrive in number 10 as the Alastair Campbell of the Tory government. So yes, I do think I like Andy. Actually, he's a very efficient, clear-headed.
It's not enough, Henry.
No, I didn't say it was. I was going to say he's a very clear-headed, efficient person. But this, whatever my affection for him, is that he really, this is important, and he has to answer the questions on it.
It does raise questions for Cameron, because if you look at what Cameron's done, essentially the new Conservatives, whatever you want to call them, the Cameroonies, they were all obsessed, starting in the early years of this decade, with how Tony Blair won in 97. And they've all, everything's followed the Blair playbook. There's one point where you could actually just see in Cameron's speeches, word for word transcriptions of writing from Philip Gould or Peter Mandelson a decade before. And one thing they wanted was their Alistair Campbell. Now, whatever you think about Alistair Campbell or his policies, he's not dead, an impressive figure. He could have been a cabinet minister if he hadn't done what he did. But so they get Andy Coulson figured as Alistair Campbell. Well, he's starting to look a bit more like Damien McBride, I'm afraid to say.
So soon.
Well, yes, I mean, I'd agree with that. And he does owe us a lot of answers. But he actually, I have to say, in his job, he performs very straightforwardly.
As thousands of hacked people who've had their privacy invaded can tell you.
I'm not defending him, I'm just saying the guy I know.
Well, let's cast our eyes up from the dodgy dealings of Fleet Street and talk about the police and criminal matters a bit more generally. And this week saw the first official report into policing at the G20 demo in April, where the newspaper vendor Ian Tomlinson died. Now, Paul Lewis is the Guardian reporter who broke that story, and I asked him what he thought of Chief Inspector Dennis O'Connor's findings.
Although it's couched in very calm language, reading between the lines, that he found some quite serious failings. I mean, the police force, for example, ahead of the demonstration, had no specific intelligence that there was going to be widespread disorder. Now, that wasn't what they were telling us. They were telling us that there was going to be mayhem on the streets, that, if you remember, city workers were supposed to not wear suits because they might be subjected to vigilante attacks, that people might enter buildings, and all of that appears to have been based on no specific intelligence. I mean, that's one of several failings which I think he identified.
So the police don't have very good intelligence. Can you say anything about the kind of training they have for these sort of situations?
Well, you could look at that in two ways. One of them is the commanders at the top level who set the policy and their understanding and their schooling in the law. The other, if we look for a second at the guys on the ground, the rank and file officers holding the batons and the shields, they get trained at a place in Gravesend, which is a kind of like riot training centre. And journalists from here and elsewhere have been there before. And essentially, it's practice in how to deal with really, really violent, unruly crowds. And, you know, rightly so, they should learn how to do that. But what O'Connor said was that actually what they're not being taught is how to deal with peaceful, if partly slightly disruptive, protests.
In the end, do you think the greater change from policing is going to come from reports like the one we've had this week, or rather by changes in technology and the police feeling that they've got more surveillance than they had in the past?
I think it's almost certainly the latter. And what will be remembered about the G20 demonstration is the fact that there were all of these cameras, mobile phones and digital cameras, that recorded the activities of police. And then in the days and weeks and months afterwards, were used to hold them to account. And police officers on the ground are going to be constantly aware of that. The other key thing is they're not just being watched by citizen journalists by the side of the road. They've also got their own surveillance cameras. And what we've found out in the last 6 months for the first time is that those surveillance cameras are catching police out, as well as catching what they would call potential criminals out. That is providing and will provide a new and quite strong layer of accountability for the future.
Teachers and nurses, of course, have had an overdose of reform. But listening to that makes you think, doesn't it, Nick, that the police have got away with a caution. Are they reformable, do you think?
There's two specific questions. There's about what happened at the G20. And with that, I think it's as much about culture and mentality. Because what happened there was an unarmed man who wasn't swearing at the police or shouting at them or threatening them, as other people were, you know, don't gloss all over that, is walking away with his back to a police officer and is then attacked. Now that is about a culture within the police force. So that kind of behaviour is okay, and you can, in some senses, all these reports are slightly dangerous, and the arguments about structures and they use kettling, or shouldn't they? Because it turns what is just a failure of, you know, just a failure to abide by basic civilized standards, by basic English policing standards, into somehow a technical managerial issue.
But there is a thing about. There's a sort of systemic point here, which is when Paul talks about this place in Gravesend where they go and get trained, apparently the rank and file officers get put behind a shield and they have Molotov cocktails lobbed at them, and that is their training. When, in fact, we know quite a lot about crowd psychology and all of that. Isn't it intended on senior officers to sort of start building that psychology into the way that they train them?
Well, you just have to say Britain is a free country. People have the right to protest, first and foremost. 99% of protests pass off peacefully. 99% aren't threats. We are training you for an extraordinary event, you know, being attacked with Molotov cocktails, a riot, in fact. But, you know, you have to remember, this is when you're policing demonstrations, you might spend your whole career and never encounter this. If the training solely consists of putting people in extreme situations, they will react to normal events as if they're extreme events.
But Henry, the press have their part to play too, didn't they, in particular run up the G20, because there were many reports about, you know, expect riots.
Yeah, but that was led by the Home Office. I mean, I think that was entirely led by the Home Office. In fact, and the Home Office has been doing this for several months, not just talking about G20, but talking about the way that crime is going to increase, violence is going to increase because of the recession. Mm. There is a sort of
summer of rage.
It's a weird hopefulness. That the word
well, there's budgets to think about as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and particularly at that time of year, you're quite right. But I think there was another point here: is that there is this. I mean, certainly, if you talk to senior police officers like Ken Jones, who was, I think, is just about to leave or already has left ACPO, you find a person who completely understands the right to assemble and to protest freely, and that it is a very important part of our society. And almost every senior police officer you meet, apart from that bloke in North Wales, understand this and sign up to it. So there's something going wrong between the top part of the command and the bottom part of the police force. I think the other important point is that the way that the police treat the public, and that, I don't know if anyone in this room has come across the police, incidentally, while they've been policing some kind of demonstration, but you find that attitude is hostile, aggressive, unpleasant, officious, and this just does not need. And I think that lack of respect for the public is something which came from, I believe, the lack of respect in the Home Office and the Labour Party for the traditional freedoms of this country.
It is very, very odd. What a tin ear for liberty New Labour has, and a lot of the sort of officials around them. I mean, you can have an argument about identity cards, all the technical side of it, which I'm sure Henry knows very well. But you know, if you were to say to as I have said, I'm very sorry, you know, I'm English. We don't do that here. Mm. They look at you as if, what are you talking about? And they have no feel for the history of this country. And they regard people who do as somehow foolish or anti-modern or they don't understand that there are things you can't do in Britain. And if you do them, you will face ridicule and contempt.
But in a particular case of the G20 and the Metropolitan Police, if there's one politician who possibly, Boris Johnson, has a role on the MPA. Oh, have we discussed that enough? Is that being brought to light enough?
Well, Boris came out with something about, what was he saying? The orcs of Mordor are about to sweep through the city. Now, people like to forget this. There were people on that demonstration who were up for a fight, who were there for a fight. There were some, you know, real weirdos, people who just went along for violence. But the Met has had quite a good record over the past decade in handling them and containing them, and no one's died or gone to hospital or anything like that. And so, you know, I do wonder if Johnson, you know, people go on because he's very charming and funny, and have I got news for you? But he does strike me more as a columnist than a politician.
Quite. Henry, because one of the ideas that the Tories are coming up with is directly elected police boards. Do you think that at a time when it's not clear who took what decision, that an elected element to the police would be a good idea, or would it be a sort of competing?
If that is a way to acquire more scrutiny for the public, yes. I'm not sure about the exact practicalities of it, but I do know that a large number of decisions about policy are being taken in ACPO, which is a private limited company,
and are therefore not, and is therefore not open to freedom of information requests. And I think this is a very bad situation to have such an important policy-making body unaccountable. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. And I think the interface between ACPO and the Home Office is something that we need to look at and something that MPs need to examine much more closely, because that's where the policy is coming from.
What do you make, Henry, finally, of the argument that was at the end of that Paul Lewis clip just there, which is that the surveillance state here can bite both ways, in that the police are being held to account now not by structures or worthy reports from Dennis O'Connor or whoever else, but by sometimes their own surveillance tape. Paul had some stuff of them up to no good in at the climate camp. As someone who's written and expressed a lot of anxiety about the surveillance state, do you think it has a positive side here?
Well, I think that probably they can get to the film before anyone else. So I slightly worry that we're going to rely on public CCTV systems for an accountability there. But I would say that the thing that the police don't understand, a lot of politicians don't understand, is that there is a new generation, broadly speaking, 20 to 35, which has come up with an entirely different set of values and is very concerned about climate change, hasn't got jobs, is highly educated, knows how to use technology and stuff. And these lumbering people making policy just don't get it. They should expose themselves to the sort of attitudes and determination that is alive in that generation.
Nick is very meekly putting his little finger up since he's in class.
No. I mean, I'm normally very suspicious of futurism and everything's changing, but this is changing so fast, and it does have positive impacts, I would say, on that. I mean, the MP's expenses scandal could not have happened 30 years ago. There's no way you could have moved hundreds of thousands of receipts out of Westminster without the police noticing you and stopping you. Now you can just put it on a disc, put it in your pocket, off you go. I mean, the world is changing very, very fast on that.
Well, if you want more about policing, then go to www.guardian.co.uk/G20.
If there's one institution that's even harder to reform than the police, it's the House of Lords. Next week, we're told that we can expect a bill that would at the very least remove the hereditary principle from the upper house. This feels like something of a last hurrah, since over the last decade there's been scant progress. Michael White gives us his take on the historical institution of the House of Lords.
White Noise with Michael White.
Did you catch Baroness Campbell's speech in the Lords last night? Probably not, but it was powerful stuff. The campaigning peer was born with spinal muscular atrophy and should have died in infancy. Instead, at 50, in her wheelchair, she was opposing the Blairite Lord Falconer's amendment to the coroner's bill. It would lift the threat of prosecution from those who helped terminally ill patients go abroad to that Swiss clinic for the purpose of assisted suicide. I tick all the boxes and would have had no trouble persuading two doctors to give consent. 3 years ago, two persuaded me it was time to go on my way, Lady Campbell revealed. Don't vote for this, she said. Peers voted not to. It's a funny old place, the House of Lords, all plush red leather, Puget brass and gold paint, carved warriors in medieval armour on the upper walls. Victorian nostalgia for a lost age. Yet it does good work, and I'm fond of it. Perhaps it's old age, mine, and familiarity. The peers know a lot, and are beyond mere ambition, most of them, Lord Mandelson. Every day, 300 or so turn up, unpaid expenses only, for work on difficult topics or detailed legislative scrutiny. They make mistakes, don't we all? They let us down sometimes, so do elected MPs. But as I see one hobbling in on sticks, I marvel at their energy, commitment, and that lingering ego. Since Labour's 1999 reforms, the most sweeping of a century, there are just 92 hereditaries left. That's out of 700 or so expelled. They add eccentricity and colour to the life peers, a mixture of the great and good and not so good. Time servers, many of them, sent there for one crafty reason or another. Between them, they know a lot. The half-reformed House, neither hereditary nor elected but appointed, is theoretically indefensible, of course, but no party has a majority here. The whips are gentle. In its way, it works. Change is coming. Peers don't like it, but they know the ways of the world. Adapt and survive.
Adapt and survive, as if something's going to happen in the next year and they'll have to deal with it, Nick. I mean, it just seems to me it's wishful thinking.
It was very wishful, sentimental English establishment stuff from Michael White. Look, the advantage of democracy over other systems of government, it's often hard to see, is you can throw the scoundrels out. We cannot throw the scoundrels out of the upper house. They do not have to stand for election, unlike every other Western democracy. The, even the change that's supposed to be coming out, that's not going to happen. Mm. It's not going to happen.
Why not?
Well, because if the House of Lords doesn't want it, it doesn't want reform, it will send the bill back to the Commons and there won't be time before the next election to put it through. So we're going to have an extraordinary situation where Labour has been in power for, what, 13 years? And at the end of it all, we still don't have a democratic second chamber. Yeah, a democratic second chamber was promised by Lloyd George in 1911. And the centre-left in Britain, you mark my words, I'm telling you, it's an Old Testament prophet here, we will regret that when the Tories in power, because however charming or eccentric we are meant to see the House of Lords, it is not a legitimate chamber. Therefore, you cannot, an opposition cannot mount attacks from a House of Lords, because it lacks the basic legitimacy of democracy. When Labour's in opposition, you know, old peers and twiddling about, they're not going to get headlines. They're not going to push the case against the Tories. And Labour will regret its betrayal of democratic values.
Henry, I mean, what the Cabinet Minister said to us this week, that, you know, that their language and their strategy is about the high ground, about appearing. They've got to use the next year to show that they really wanted this, which is just insane.
Well, it is. My view is that the principal change, the priority for reform is the House of Commons. And I do not think that the House of Lords is anything cries out for the kind of reform that we need in the House of Commons. And Nick talks about legitimacy. Well, I kind of see that argument, but we don't have any legitimacy in the House of Commons. The Labour government was and has been running this country on 22% of the electorate, on the popular vote. 22% of the electorate, not the popular vote. It's about 30% of the popular vote. That is not legitimacy in my mind. The House of Lords during that time has successfully opposed some of the balmier, more authoritarian measures, for which I thank those people. I mean, they produced a wonderful report earlier this year on the database state in Britain, and a very good articulation of the problems. It wasn't just a whole lot of old farts sitting in a room worrying about not being in the 20th century. It was a very important contribution to the debate. Yeah,
but Henry, surely anyone that would replace, any system that would replace that would be just as stuffed full of interested intellectual...
Well, I hope so. I mean, I don't go along with the modern faith that democracy guarantees liberty and accountability. It plainly doesn't. What I believe in is an engagement of the public. Now, if we can engage the public in a better way in the election of the Lords, then I'm happy. But I'm not happy just to turn over the Lords to the party machine and the whips.
Well, look, Henry, and the only countries in the world that have good accountability and liberty are democracies. So first of all, don't be too dismissive of democracy.
No, I was saying it doesn't guarantee it, which is a different thing.
And you also have to fight. And second, look, if George Bush or Barack Obama has got a majority in the House of Representatives and is putting forward something through, he's still got to pass the Senate. And the Senate can throw it back. He's got to get the Senate on side. We've had, with Thatcher and with Blair, we've had governments pushing through ill-thought-out measures, measures you might oppose politically, measures that were barely even intelligible to the judges who had to enforce them. But because the House of Lords lacks democratic legitimacy, its objections... Henry's quite right. His objections might be very good, but it's like objections from sort of old buffers in the long room. You know,
of the things we've got to do in this country is to somehow re-engage the electorate in making these important decisions about who is going to make our laws, and that doesn't look like we're doing. And I believe that the way to start with that is not with the Lords, but to give substantial reforms in the House of Commons to make people feel more engaged with the process.
What sort of reforms in the Commons?
Oh, in the Commons, well, I certainly think that we should reduce the power of the whips in the voting of select committee chairmen. I think that we have to look at the way the guillotine has been used over the last 15 years. I think we absolutely have to realise how much of our law is being made by unscrutinised statutory instruments.
But, Henry, I accept much of that, but there is a question of principle here. When you've got 92 people who are there because of birthright, What legitimacy can the Lords have, however good its arguments are?
I'm against the hereditary.
And isn't it very good if Labour gets rid of these
It is no advance to replace aristocrats with quangocrats. Yeah. I mean, really, isn't it?
But we weren't suggesting that.
Henry, you say we need to engage people about how we govern this country. Well, how about giving them a vote? Sorry to sound old-fashioned about that.
Yeah, but the vote's not being used, Nick.
Watch the next election, Henry. You will see the voters turning
well, we
on
must go on,
with a
on
vengeance.
We must go on the evidence of the last elections. The votes aren't being used. And they aren't being used because people do not feel that it has any effect on their lives, that they don't have any power.
Well, they've just been through the worst crash since the 1930s. I think that people have learned that politics does matter.
Yeah, but Nick, you're kind of not really thinking here. What we need to think about is whether we should change the voting system and whether that voting system should perhaps be applied first to the House of Lords. That would be an interesting way of moving this forward.
So a re-engagement panacea might be a referendum at the next election on electoral reform and House of Lords reform at the same time.
I definitely think so. I think this is a really important part of the next election. Except it's not in the interest of the parties to...
No.
The big reform that people haven't... some very interesting backbench Labour MPs have been talking about for years is to just be honest about how Britain's governed and say the executive is so powerful and Parliament is so weak, what we ought to do is have a French or American system where we elect a Prime Minister and then have an independent legislature which has some pride in itself, where Congress has pride in itself, and can hold it to account. Because the problem of our legislature is most people in it, in the Commons, want to be in the executive, which is not a very good way of getting a strong Parliament.
This sort of big idea for reform is exactly the kind of stuff that's on the New Politics website, which you can go to by going to the comment is free bit of The Guardian and then clicking on the rainbow-coloured New Politics logo. We're going to turn to Afghanistan in the week where 7 British soldiers were killed, bringing the total death toll to 171. Several times that number of Afghanis have, of course, been killed. And this week, Defence Secretary Bob Ainsworth warned that there'd be more deaths, but called for support and, yes, patience.
Let's be under no illusion. The situation in Afghanistan is serious, and it is not yet decided. The way forward is hard and dangerous. More lives will be lost, and our resolve is going to be tested.
You were originally on what was called the muscular left, I think, in favour of the action in Afghanistan. But if you had someone in your family out there now, would you be clear about telling them what they were fighting for?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it seems reasonably clear. I'd say they're fighting a just war against an enemy who has to be beaten. I'll obviously worry about them. It sort of depends. This debate.
But to what end? The government seems increasingly woolly on what the end point is, doesn't it?
Well, the end is to, first of all, stop Afghanistan and increasingly now the Pakistani borderlands being a launchpad for international terrorism, which, you know, every bomb plot in Britain, even those which are undertaken by British citizens, has that connection, that is the centre of it all. That seems to me to be quite clear. Now, the only question is, and I think we still have not quite got our heads around the scale of our economic losses, is whether Britain, particularly when in Europe, frankly, you know, rich countries aren't prepared to rich postmodern countries aren't prepared to fight, does Britain carry on with that level of commitment in blood and treasure? Or does it say, well, actually, we're now very much a second-ranked nation and in decline, and we just can't afford to carry on doing it? But that's not from the same as saying that the war isn't just.
I mean, Henry, can you see what the end point is that the government thinks it's working towards?
I think that's a problem. I don't think there's I think the end point is quite clear. We want to beat the Taliban. I think the point between then and now and then is much less clear. I don't think it's a clear strategy. We don't have the money. I mean, we really do not have the money to do this. We're relying on American helicopters. And the army itself is very tired. I know quite a lot. I know a young man who's just about to go and take his platoon there. And, you know, they're very admirable people and they're very well trained and clear in their minds about what they're doing. But in a way, we're asking them to sacrifice too much, to go on repeatedly going back from Iraq, then to Afghanistan on several tours. These guys are leaving the army in droves, and that means you're losing an awful lot of training and experience and know-how and all the other things that you lose when young men leave the service. I worry that the Labour government has absolutely no idea how to conclude this or no timescale at all. And I think if you listen to what ministers are saying, they don't really have any idea. You don't see a clear strategy. I think the surge is probably given them some kind of breathing space because the Americans have brought helicopters that we didn't have. And the problem about helicopters and these vehicles we're using, the Viking vehicle, is that, you know, they're just too exposed. And helicopters do at least save people from these roadside bombs. We haven't got enough of them. So we're bound to sacrifice people needlessly because we don't have the equipment. And that's a disgraceful position for our forces to be in.
There's also a feeling that the government isn't behind the soldiers. I mean, Gordon Brown's never been that interested. But there was a thing in all, you remember when James Pennell and everyone resigned, a point that just got lost. The defence secretary just walked out for no good reason anyone could see, while British men and women were at war, were taking heavy casualties, and he just seemed to walk out because, he was finding it all a bit much, and he didn't like Gordon Brown.
He didn't even say that. It was just,
I'm just going, bye. Yeah. How disgraceful is that?
A very good point.
And they get Bob Ainsworth.
Bob Ainsworth,
who's ranked 23 out of the 25 members of the cabinet.
The chap who invented the vacuum cleaner. What's his name? Lord Dyson. He was somehow put in the Ministry of Defence Procurement, and he goes off because he wants to see the world.
It's not Dyson, it's Trayson, isn't it?
Whatever. You're confusing two people.
Oh, right.
I think Dyson.
Yeah, you know, the vacuum cleaner guy. And, you know, and he just wanders off because he wants to have a gap year. No, you know, the army is fighting some of the toughest battles it's fought since Korea. And the ministers back home are just saying, I want to go skiing or something.
The crucial thing is it will not win. It cannot win.
Well, most wars aren't settled in neat battles. Most wars don't end with
Waterloo. Well, I mean, the point is, Nick, surely the crucial point is the fact that we're there. I was originally for the deployment, but the fact that we're there has encouraged large numbers of people to flood and go towards the Taliban and fight for the Taliban. So the presence actually acts as the cause or the encourager of the war. It acts as a stimulant,
in which case you have to say, well, you pull out and you go back to a situation where Afghanistan is an al-Qaeda base, where the pressure on the very weak democratic government of Pakistan grows ever more severe. Well, the tensions between India and Pakistan, you know, I'm very sorry, there's a subcontinental crisis there.
Incidentally, I thought the map in The Guardian this morning, which puts that area on one page, is completely fascinating.
It was very good, wasn't it?
It really is a good piece of journalism in the sense that it gives you the whole area and you see the linkedness, the connectedness between these crises in Iran and then you go over to Pakistan.
So there we have it, a moment of consensus and a moment of product placement on which to draw things to a conclusion today. So rush out and buy the paper and save all of our jobs. And thanks to our colleagues Nick Cohen and Henry Porter for venturing up to the third floor here in King's Cross.
Politics Weekly is produced by Francesca Panetta.
I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Alex Stratton.
Until next week.
Goodbye.